Men and women, all ages, are invited to share in an evening of inspiration at the open house of the Jesse Dweck Alav HaShalom City Learning Center at the Edmond Safra Synagogue. Monday, February 9th at 8 p.m., our guest speaker will be Rabbi Eli Mansour. The synagogue is located at 11 East 63rd Street in Manhattan, between 5th Avenue and Madison Avenues. That's 11 East 63rd, between 5th and Madison, Monday, February 9th at 8 p.m. Come and be part of the history. Thank you.
Beruchim Abaim, ladies. We are studying Perashat Bo. Perashat Bo, we're in the middle of the Makot, the middle of the 10 plagues. The Achamim actually give us a hint. In last week's Perasha, we read about 7 of the plagues. And the name of last week's Perasha is Va'era. Va'era, the first two letters is Vav Aleph. Vav is 6, Aleph is 1, that's 7. That hints to us the 7 plagues. This week's Perasha is called Bo. Bo is Bet Aleph, Bet is 2, Aleph is 1, that's 3. To hint to us of the 3 plagues that are in this week's Perasha. In any event, Moshe Rabbeinu goes to Paro to tell him about the plague of Arbeh. Arbeh was actually locusts that were to go and fly around Egypt, jump around Egypt, and eat up all the crop, and eat up all the leftover foods that were in the field, the fruits that were on the tree. So in the middle of the conversation of him telling Paro what's going to happen, him and Aaron were talking to Paro, the Pasuk says, Vayifin vayitzeh me'im Paro. He turned around and walked out. So the Hachemim want to know what happened. What did Paro say that Moshe abruptly should make a U-turn and just walk out of the palace in the middle of talking to him, telling him about what's going to happen? So the Hachemim tell us that when Paro heard of the impending plague, of course he got nervous for a moment, then he always changes his mind after, and he called for an immediate meeting with his advisors. His advisors were in the palace. He called the advisors to discuss, what do we do? Do we let them go? Do we take a risk? Already the empire is crumbling. The economy is bad from all the other plagues. What should we do? So when Moshe Rabbeinu saw Paro talking privately with his advisors, he walked out. From here the rabbis learn a very important lesson, how when people are conversing, and you know that it's not for you to listen, so you're not supposed to eavesdrop. Although it's a big pleasure to always position oneself so you can overhear the action and overhear the gossip and what he said and what she said, and you know, just to get a little news, some juicy events. However, the Torah is teaching a very important lesson that Moshe Rabbeinu said, all right, listen, this conversation is not for me. Obviously, Paro wants to discuss it with his advisors. I have no place being here. So he walked out. This is teaching you the decency of character of Moshe Rabbeinu. They tell a story in Tsarist Russia. I don't have to tell you what it was to live in those days under the Tsars of Russia. They were tyrants. They were real cruel dictators. And anti-Semites is an understatement. Every Monday and Thursday they were throwing another Jew in jail for no reason, libels. They'd make up the false claims, throw them in prison, and they would torture them. So there was once a great rabbi that was a victim of one of these libels of the Russians, and they had put him in prison, and they had brought him to court. So in the courtroom, he's standing in front of the bar with the judges and some of the advisors, and they wanted to talk about what they're going to do to the rabbi. So they started to talk in French. So the rabbi won't understand what they're talking about. So the rabbi immediately stepped back and walked out of the room. So they call him back and they speak to him. They say, what type of arrogance? Who asked you to move? Who asked you to walk away? We're in the middle of talking over here. We told you to stand and you walk back? What gives you the right to do such a thing? He said, I know why you're talking in French, because you don't want me to understand what you're saying, because it's personal, but little do you know, but I speak French, I'm fluent in French. And therefore I didn't feel it proper for me to fool you and stand here, and you're going to think that I don't understand what you're talking about, and I really do, so it's not private. I'm not supposed to hear this conversation. It's a private conversation. It's not for my ears. So I walked out in order to give you privacy. When the Russians saw such integrity, such a rabbi, such honesty, so they said, you must be innocent. This, we can't punish a man for such a crime that is so sensitive of other people's privacy. And when they asked the rabbi, where did you learn that from? He said, from this week's parasha. He says, if Moshe Rabbeinu gives Paro his privacy and lets him talk with his advisor, and doesn't stand there trying to get a piece of the information, so then already that teaches me to do the same, and that's a lesson for all of us as well. Furthermore, in the parasha, we read how when the Jews came out of Egypt on that fateful night in Jewish history, the dogs did not bark that night. As the Pasuk writes, Ulchol b'nei Yisrael lo yehiratz kelev l'shono. The dogs were silent that night. Normally when there's action, when there's commotion, when there's a lot of things happening, dogs become annoying. And they bark and they make noise and all that. But on the night when we left Egypt, not one dog barked, they didn't open their mouth, they were silent. The Torah even tells us that they got rewarded for that. Later in history, the Torah writes a law that says, anytime you have not kosher meat, what are you supposed to do with it? So the Torah says, throw it to the dogs. Why? Because on the night when we went out of Egypt, they acted well, they had good behavior, so therefore they get their payback. God does not hold back the reward for anybody. Even if a dog does something, probably wasn't even in his ability to control it. God made the dog not bark. He shouldn't even reward the dog. The dog didn't do it. The dog doesn't have free will. It's not like the dog said, you know what, I'm going to be a good dog, then I'm not going to bark. God obviously controlled the dog from barking. But still, since he was obedient and listened, so Borei Olam rewards. That's good news for us, that there's a lot of reward going to happen for all our good deeds and for all our mitzvot. But I saw a nice Hiddush. There's a story told in the city of Brisk in Europe. The rabbi of the city of Brisk was a rabbi called Rav Soloveitchik. Big, big gaon. And at the time, there was a fight between two wealthy people. Two major people in the community were arguing with each other. So the rabbi wanted to make peace. So he said, let me go to a third wealthy man, influential man, and maybe he could broker the peace. So he went to the third man and said, listen, this is the situation, they're arguing, it's going to escalate. We have to intercede now when we could stop the argument from becoming too overwhelming. So the third guy tells the rabbi, you know what, rabbi? To me, being neutral is more important. That's a bigger mitzvah. I don't want to get involved now. I stick my head involved. It's only going to make things. I want to stay pav. I want to stay neutral. The rabbi didn't like that answer. I'm giving you an opportunity to make peace. And you're coming along and saying you want to be neutral? So the rabbi made a comment. His comment was more a witty comment. Because it's really not true in the fullest sense, but this is what he said. He says, now I know why the dogs didn't bark that night when they came out of Egypt. Why? Because the Gemara says, from the way dogs act, you can tell what's going on in the world. How? The Gemara says, when Chas v'Shalom, the angel of death is close in the streets, dogs bark ferociously. When Eliyahu HaNavi is walking through the town, the Gemara says the dogs are very playful, and the dogs are very charming, and they're enjoying. So the rabbi said, now I know what happened the night the Jews came out of Egypt. The dogs were in a dilemma, because the angel of death was coming out, killing all the firstborns. So they said, oh, we got to bark. But at the same time, the Jews were being redeemed. Eliyahu HaNavi must have been around with all the redemption. So the dogs didn't know, should we bark or should we act playful? So what did the dogs do? They were neutral. They didn't do anything. They didn't bark. They didn't play. They just kept quiet. So he says, from here you understand that neutrality is for dogs. But for human beings who have intellect, you can't be neutral. You have to make the peace. And therefore he was giving a strong word of Musar to that. Oh, you want to be neutral. What do you mean? The dog that came out of Egypt doesn't know whether to laugh or to bark, so he just kept quiet. You have a brain. And from here you learn that one that has an opportunity to make peace between families, between siblings, between man and wife, one cannot hide behind the cloak of neutrality and say, oh, I don't want to get involved, you know, it's not my business. The Torah is telling you, it is your business. You have to negotiate and you have to take effort to make peace between people. The Gemara writes, not too many mitzvot do we get reward in this world. For good reason. Because there's nothing really in this world valuable enough to pay us for the mitzvah. For example, the Hafetz Chaim once, he was living in a time of famine, and they once came to him and they said, Rabbi, we need to end this famine. So one of the guys said, I have an idea. Let me cash in one of my mitzvot. So Hafetz says, what do you mean cash in one of your mitzvot? My tefillin that I put on this morning, let me get the reward for that. Let me ask God to pay us for that, and maybe the famine will go away in the zechut of the tefillin. I'll take it now. So the Hafetz Chaim started to chuckle. So he said, why, it's not enough? Two tefillin. He said, you know, he said, you're talking, it's like a kid that goes into a 1 cent, 2 cent store to buy a candy that's a penny, and he gives the clerk a $100 bill. You're not going to make change now for a $100 bill for a penny item. What is the clerk going to tell the kid? Take the candy. Go, yeah, we're not going to charge you a penny for the kid. Just get out of here. So you want to take a tefillin. You know what a tefillin's worth is? It's infinite. Now you want to go to God and cash it in to get rid of a famine? Compared to the value of tefillin, the famine is nothing. It's a couple of pennies. On the contrary, it's God's not going to make change for such a transaction. To show you the value of what the mitzvot are. That's why God cannot pay us for the mitzvot in this world. Because He can give us China. It's not enough. He can give us the whole Western Hemisphere. It's not enough for one mitzvah. The mitzvot are eternal. However, there are certain mitzvot that God gives us, not the principal payment, but the interest. Every mitzvah that you do, there's a principal payment, and as it sits in the bank, you get interest. There's a, they call that in the Gemara perot, the fruit. One of the mitzvot that you benefit in this world is Hava'at Shalom ben Ish le'ishto ben Ish le'havero. Making peace between friends and making peace between couples that are fighting, man and wife. This is the greatest mitzvah that God cannot wait to pay you till the next world. God brings you beracha immediately. And that's why throughout history, our hachamim always took the opportunity, instead of saying, I don't want to get my hands dirty, don't get me involved. On the contrary, they threw themselves in the mess, and it's a mess when you get involved with people. I don't have to tell you that. And usually what ends up happening is the two people make peace, and they both agree that they hate the peacemaker. And then he becomes the bad guy. And the guy says, I was just trying to help. What did you do? No, but you said, and he said, they walk away being friends, and they go out for lunch, and they don't call you because you would have got to make peace. We know that. It's not a rewarding feeling always. Sometimes you're going to get burned. But what? The Torah is telling you that's how important. Because I heard a story about Rav Shach, Alav HaShalom, the former Rosh Yeshiva, Panovich Yeshiva, the former Gadol Ador, the greatest rabbi of the generation. If it's possible to be true, but I think I heard the story correctly, that at the end of his life, when he was maybe in his mid-90s, if this is possible, he used to drive, or they used to drive him, every day from Bnei Berak to Yerushalayim, which is like a 45-minute drive, back and forth. And he did it for a year or two. He did it for a long time. And you know, imagine how busy the rabbi is. What is he doing every day in Jerusalem? And they used to see him go into an apartment somewhere, and he used to be talking to a couple. And there was a couple that was going through some rocky times, and they were having Shalom Bayit issues. And the rabbi himself, you could imagine the schedule and that. How busy is this man? This man has the whole entire world on his shoulders. But somehow he finds time every day to go to Yerushalayim, where you couldn't let somebody else make the peace. No, he had an opportunity, and he sat with them, and he made the shalom. Again, this goes to show, nobody could say, well, I'm too busy. You don't have the schedule Rav Shach had. If he was able to make time for that, that has to become the first and foremost priority of people, to make the peace. Neutrality is not the answer. Later on in the parasha, we're given the first mitzvah in the book of Shemot. As I think we've said in past, there was only three mitzvot in the book of Bereshit. All Bereshit, three mitzvot. I think the mitzvot we mentioned were Peru Urvu, having children was the first mitzvah. The second mitzvah was Brit Milah, circumcision. And the third mitzvah was not eating the Gid HaNasheh. That's the vein in the animal that Yaakov got hit in the leg, so we can't eat that vein. The fourth mitzvah in the Torah is HaChodesh HaZeh Lachem Rosh Chodashim. What does that mean? God told Moshe and Aharon that Jewish people are going to have a unique calendar. The calendar is going to be based on the cycle of the moon. While the calendar of the Goyim is based on the cycle of the sun. They have a solar calendar. The solar calendar is 365 days a year. We have a lunar calendar. It's based on the cycle of the moon, which is only 354 days a year. And the rabbis asked, why do Jews base their calendar on the moon? What's the message? What's the lesson? So one of the explanations I heard is that the moon, as you know, is a dark planet. The moon doesn't have any light of its own. The moon only gets its light from the sun. If you look at the solar system, you see that the sun and the moon, they're parallel to each other. And it's only a reflection from the light of the sun that the moon has its light. And that's why when the moon is in certain positions that it's not in front of the sun, you don't see any of it. And as it gets in the proper position, you start to see a quarter of the moon, a half of the moon. And then when it's in perfect position, you see a full moon. But on its own, it has nothing. And the rabbis learned a great lesson from this. Rabbis say that Moshe Rabbeinu was like the sun. And Yeshua, his student, was like the moon. What are they saying? They were trying to say that Yehoshua was the perfect student. He did not deviate from any of the teachings of his rabbi. He was like the moon positioned in front of the sun. All Yehoshua's light was not anything of his own. Anything that he taught the Jewish people was something that he heard from Moshe Rabbeinu. He didn't create new ideas. He didn't veer off the path. He didn't start coming up with new concepts. He didn't start creating strange ideas that were never heard. He was loyal. The moon is loyal in the sense that its light only comes because it's positioned in front of the sun. And the lesson the Torah is coming to tell you, as Jews, we, in our generation, have to be like the moon in the sense we have to have a loyalty to the Hachamim and to the traditions that preceded us. Heaven forbid a generation like ours should come along and start tinkering with the religion. And start to say, well, this mitzvah, well, this doesn't apply so much today. We don't have to do this anymore. Like the conservative and the reform did. The conservative and the reform, they're not like the moon. They came along and they veered off. And they tried to create their own artificial light. And they tried to create their own artificial religion. And look where it got them. Today, these branches of Judaism have veered off the course where there's so much intermarriage and so much modernization that you can't even tell that they're Jewish. But it's only us, the Orthodox Jews, that have kept that parallel between moon and sun, between a loyalty to the traditions of our parents, of our grandparents, of our rabbis, of our heritage. And therefore the Torah is telling us, we count according to the moon. The moon represents a loyalty to a greater light. And therefore, we're not allowed to come and start creating newfangled ideas. Even unfortunately today in Orthodoxy, there are new branches of modern Orthodoxy and these type of things that felt that the old way of doing things is not enough. We have to adapt, we have to change, we have to fix, we have to... Well, the religion was not good enough for Hacham Yaakov Katzin, our former chief rabbi. It's not good enough for Hacham Baruch, our rabbi now, may live and be well. It's not good enough for their Hacham. Who asked somebody with less wisdom to come and teach these greats exactly how the religion should be administered. A true student is like the moon. He positions himself in front of his rabbis and his heritage, and he only receives the light, but he does not try to create a new light. There's another lesson. Why does God give them this mitzvah now? He tells them, "Ha'chodesh hazeh lachem rosh chodashim." The rabbis say God even showed Moshe the new moon, what it looks like. He said, when you see the moon like this, then you know it's Rosh Chodesh. Actually, on Rosh Chodesh, you can't even see the moon. It's very, very small on Rosh Chodesh. In the olden days, they used to have witnesses that would come to Jerusalem, to the Beit HaMikdash, and testify, we saw the new moon. And the rabbis would ask them, what position was it? How did it look? They would give them all types of interrogations. And after they would come to the conclusion that they're good witnesses, the rabbis would say, Mikudash, Mikudash, Mikudash. They would sanctify the new month. That's how it was done in the olden days. It was done by witnesses. But why would God tell Moshe Rabbeinu this law now? Ha'chodesh hazeh lachem. This month belongs to you, and this is the way you sanctify the months of the year. So I heard an explanation. Until this point, the Jews were slaves in Egypt. A slave is lacking one of the most important privileges that we have as free human beings. And what is that item that the slave is lacking? He's lacking his time. A slave has no time. His time does not belong to him. A slave's time is subject to his master. A slave cannot decide, well, I'll be back in 5 minutes. No, you don't have 5 minutes of your own. A slave does not decide when he's going to take his vacation or when he's going to start to work. One thing about a slave is his time does not belong to him. And now, after 210 years in slavery, God comes to Moshe with the first mitzvah and says, Ha'chodesh hazeh, starting this month, lachem, the month belongs to you. God now is giving back our time to the Jewish. Now you have rights to use your time what you want. Now you no longer have to answer to Paro. God was giving us the concept of time back by giving us Rosh Chodesh. He said, this is the first month that it's yours. Ha'chodesh hazeh lachem. It belongs to you. The question is, what are the Jews going to do with their time? And 50 days after we came out of Egypt, God gave us the Torah. 613 mitzvot, which if a person's following them with the right way, it can fill his time from morning until night without any break in between. So therefore, a Jew's pastime is supposed to be in the study of Torah and the performance of the mitzvot. Further in the parasha, we read about the strictness of Hametz on Pesach. I know it's a little early to talk about cleaning our homes for Pesach, but it is the parasha, and we'll just say one word about this concept of Hametz. Even though usually after winter vacation people start to talk about Passover, so maybe we're on time. Hametz is so serious in Jewish law, as the women know even more than the men, that even a crumb of Hametz, poses a problem. I mean, you could have milk that falls into meat, and there's a way to negotiate. There's 60 times against it. It's okay, don't worry. There's ways to get out of milk and meat, but there's no way to get out of Hametz. Even a drop, a morsel, poses a great problem. And the question the rabbis ask is, what's the message? Why is the Torah, at least once a year, telling us to get rid of any inkling of Hametz? So I saw from one of the rabbis called the B'nai Yisachar, he says like this, matzah, if you ever went to a bakery to see how they make matzah, somebody is in control of the matzah at all times. Kneading it, moving it, cutting it, shaping it, manipulating the matzah. From the moment that the water is added to the matzah, somebody must be in control of it. If somebody lets it go even for a couple of moments, Hametz, constantly is being worked. There's somebody guiding it and managing it and doing. Hametz is the exact opposite. You know when you make your halot for Shabbat, for chametz to become chametz, on the contrary, nobody can touch it, nobody can go near it. You just have to leave the dough on the counter, and it just happens by itself. Chametz is a spontaneous event. It just happens by itself without anybody involved in it. Once the dough is made, you just have to leave it. And the Torah is coming to tell you like this. Judaism, you have to remember this, ladies. We believe that nothing, I'm going to say this clearly, nothing takes place in this world without the direct control of God. From the greatest world events to the smallest minuscule events in our lives that don't even seem important, God is there managing, micromanaging. Every step is calculated from God. The only area that God doesn't intervene is in our free will, in our decision making to do right and wrong. That already God doesn't involve ourselves in. But on how much money we're going to make, that's already up to God. The number is written already, like the Hafez Chaim used to say. He says, businessmen think that they're going to make more money if they work longer hours. He says, the number is written already. As long as you're working the normal hours that you're supposed to work, you're not going to make more money by going to work longer hours. He compared it to somebody that was on a train, and he's on the front car, and he's pushing the door. So he said, what are you doing? He says, I'm trying to get the train to move faster. What are you doing? The train's going to move faster because you're pushing it. It's futile. It's a wasted attempt. And therefore, those people that think that they're in control of the world, or that they think that things just happen by itself, that there's no system, there's no order, it's just randomness and just chance, they're like the chametz. That just happens without anybody involved in it. So once you hear the Torah says, you got to rid yourself of that philosophy. Get rid of this chametz business over here. You have to know that there's a controller in the world, that there's somebody guiding it. Just like somebody guides the matzah to make matzah, the lesson is that there's divine providence. That every step and every place you are and every event that happens in your life that was designed and orchestrated specifically by God, tailor-made to reach you. And therefore, the matzah serves a great lesson. Somebody once asked, Rabbi, based on this, you should eat matzah all year round. We should be forbidden to eat chametz forever. And the answer is that 7 days of eating the matzah and understanding this already should be a good enough lesson that it'll carry over for the rest of the year. The matzah symbolizes the control of God, while the chametz just represents spontaneity of things just happening by themselves. That's why you have to get rid of every morsel. We don't want to have even an iota of such a philosophy that's anti-Torah in our midst. And after we have to get rid of everything. Later on in the parasha, we learn about the four children. I don't know if you remember, on the night of Pesach, we talk about four different sons. The wise son, the wicked son, the foolish son, and then the son that doesn't ask anything. Where did we get these children from? Arba'a banim. Where did we get these four sons from? The Torah talks about them. One of them is mentioned in this week's parasha. It's actually the Rasha. Now how do we know that the pasuk that I'm going to read is referring to the Rasha? Well, let's read it. It says, V'haya, and it'll be, Ki yomeru alechem benechem. It's going to come a day. And your sons are going to ask you, Ma ha'avodah hazot lachem? What is this avodah? What is this? What are these mitzvot that you're doing? It's going to be a son one night at the seder. He's going to ask, what is all this stuff over here? What is this matzah? What are you doing over here? So the rabbis tell us, aha, that's the rasha. And it always bothered me. How do you know that this kid's a rasha, Hazit? He's asking a question. What, your son comes to you tonight in the Pesach table and says, Dad, what's could you explain me, what's this matzah? What? Rasha? I have no right to ask a question, I'm sorry. I thought we were supposed to ask questions. Hazid, he just wants to know. So the simple explanation is, they learned it from the word avodah. He calls the mitzvot avodah, work. So you see already his attitude. Dad, what's this inconvenience? What are we doing over here? What's all these mitzvot? Matzah, the maror, and agadah. It's a pain in the neck. It's like going to work. It's a toil. It's a burden. It's cumbersome. If he would have asked that, could you explain me what the ritual is? Okay, you're a hakam, I will answer you. But to come along with that snide remark and call the mitzvot labor, as if you're trying to ridicule the mitzvah with a little sharp word of sarcasm and say, what's this avodah? Well, you consider this like construction work over here? What do you consider this like lifting a grand piano on your back, eating a piece of matzah? You call it avodah, you're a rasha. But I saw a much more beautiful explanation to this. If you look at all the other pisukim that talk about the children that ask questions to their father, the Torah says, and it'll be, ki yish alecha bincha, when your son will come and ask you. But over here it says, v'haya ki yomeru alechem, and your children will come and say to you, what is this? You see, this child over here is not asking a question. This child over here is coming in a scoffing manner, and he's just saying. He's not coming along and saying, Dad, could you explain to me what's going on over here? He's coming along with a statement, V'hayaki yomeru. Yomeru means he's going to come and say. What is he saying? What is this stupidity? That's not a question. They're making a statement. They're ready. He's decided that he has no part of this religion and he wants nothing. And therefore, in a sharp manner, in a rhetorical manner, he's coming along and telling his father. He doesn't want an answer. And that's why if you look at the answer the Torah says, on the next pasuk, the Torah says, Va'amartem, and you will say, Zevach Pesach, this is Korban Pesach, how God took him out of Egypt. And the rabbis point out, if you notice in the answer is not directed to the Rasha. The answer is directed to all the other people sitting around the table. And from here we learn a very important lesson. When somebody comes and knocks and comes just to make fun, and just to be cynical, and just to be provocative, not coming to ask to understand, and just coming to be a wise guy, to make fun of the Torah, don't answer him. Because he doesn't want an answer. But you know you have to answer? The people that are around you. Because they're going to get affected by this wise guy. And therefore the Torah says, when this son comes and starts spitting out his negative opinions about religion at the seder table, pay no attention to him. But make sure that the kids around the table get the right answer, because they're going to get influenced. And therefore you have to protect them. One of the rabbis gave a mashal. There was once a fire, God forbid, in somebody's home. So the fire department came, they saw the fire. They went to the house next door and they started to hose it down. So the guy said, what are you talking about? The fire's over there. What are you hosing down this house for? He says, well, this fire already is uncontrollable. There's no way we could put this fire out. But at least now we want to hose down the house next door, so at least it'll be drenched with water so the fire won't attach and then burn that house down. And that's the same thing with these type of negative people. When they come along and start spitting out all their, you know, problems that they have with God and religion and all their scoffing and all their jokes, you're not going to change these people. You're going to answer them. The fire has consumed these people already. But what are you supposed to do at that time? You take out yours, start watering down everybody else around the table, in order that the negativity of that son should not affect all the good people around the table. And therefore, you don't address to him. Unfortunately, we know many people, even in our community, it probably comes because of lack of education and lack of understanding. I'm sure they'll come around also. But as religion is growing in our community, and as there's a revolution that's taking place, it's a wave that's not only hitting our community, it's hitting the Jewish world at large. Judaism is on the upswing. There's classes, there's understanding, there's learning, there's mitzvot, there's performance of the mitzvot, there's kashrut. But as that happens, a lot of people who are not ready to expose themselves to it or feel threatened that this wave might come and affect them in some way, maybe directly, maybe through a spouse, maybe through their children. So they have to put up shields in order to protect them, that they shouldn't get influenced. And one of the shields is jokes and cynicism and making fun. Ah, you went to class. Have I brainwashed you? He put ideas in your mind. Can't you think for yourself? Don't you have a brain? What are you letting yourself get influenced? It's a cult. It's, they're trying to manipulate your minds. You're smarter than that. Don't fall for all these type of manipulations of speech that they try to use in order to get you to cool down and say, you know, I don't want to be looked as a zombie. I don't want to be looked like as if somebody's influencing me the wrong way. But you have to know, you don't answer. Because he's not looking for an answer. She's not looking for an answer. They're shooting. They're spraying. You don't answer such a thing. But what you have to do is, you have to go back for yourself and reinforce yourself. There, unfortunately, the fire is uncontrollable. You're not going to get it out. That you have to leave to the professionals, even to the rabbis, to deal with those pranksters. But for the people themselves, you have to act like we said in this case. Last but not least, there's another son that's mentioned in the Perasha. The Pasuk writes, V'ayakish alecha bincha machar lemor mazot. So another son is going to come and ask you at the Seder table again, mazot. Dad, what's this? So the rabbi tells, which son is that? That's the fool. That's the tipesh. That's the son that has no brains. I don't understand it. Hazid, what are they picking on the kid for? He asked his father a question. He didn't come cynically. He's not telling his father like the other guy. He's not calling it work. He's coming with an innocent question. Dad, mazot, what is that? That's the tipesh. That's the tam. So I heard a wonderful explanation once. How the rabbis knew that this is the foolish son. There was once a man that was taking a tour of the mechanical room of a ship. And you can imagine how complicated the mechanical room in a ship are. All the different machinery and all the different gauges and all the different buttons and toggles, and I mean, it's only a captain and the people that understand what's going on know exactly what every single button is. It's like going to the cockpit of a plane, and you wonder how do they know exactly what each of these buttons do, and all these different measuring utensils. I don't know how to read it, but they know how to read it. Now imagine walking into a cockpit for the first time, and you go to the pilot and say, pointing to one of the small little buttons underneath his seat, and say, what's that? And the pilot looks at you, wait, everything else you understand over there? This is the only button you don't understand over there? What's that? Which means you could walk into the cockpit and say, just give me a general understanding of what goes on over here. General understanding, I'm not going to be a pilot in 5 minutes. I'll give you, this is what we do. This goes up, this goes down, next. But you can't stop pointing to a button as if everything else is clear to you. So when you ask a pointed question like that, it's a sign of ignorance. You don't ask questions like that. So the rabbi said, this kid's sitting at the table. There's 100 things going on. There's matzah, there's maror, there's haroset, there's haggadah, there's wine, there's leaning, there's the zeroah, there's the betzah. There's a million things taking place on the night of the seder. And the kid doesn't know what anything's. He has no idea what anything's going on that night. And all of a sudden, in the middle, he gets up and says, what's that? Mazot? That's not a smart question. You want to get up and tell your father and I to say, Dad, I don't understand anything over here. Could you explain me the event? But to go now and find one item out of 100 and point it out, what's this? It's a foolish question. The lesson for us, ladies, on this is, there's a pasuk that we say every Friday night, the men say it in synagogue. David HaMelech wrote it. Pasuk goes like this. Ish ba'ar lo yeda, uksi lo yavin et zot. The ba'ar is an imbecile. David says, the imbecile doesn't understand. Ish ba'ar lo yeda, the imbecile doesn't understand. Uksil, the fool, lo yavin et zot, doesn't understand. What doesn't he understand? The fool and the imbecile don't understand. Why is it that we see wicked people flourishing? Bothers him. He sees people that are not observant, that are less than observant, less than honest, people that have no scruples, and they're flourishing. They're making a lot of money, they have a lot of health, they have a lot of success, and the fool and the imbecile, they don't understand it. Why are they flourishing? So one of the rabbis asked, why? Only the fool doesn't understand it? Even the biggest hachamim don't understand it. Nobody understands why righteous people suffer and the opposite, and wicked people prosper. Why does David HaMelech call those people that can't figure that age-old dilemma, why does he call them fools? They're not fools. Even Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't figure it out. Even the great prophets grappled with that question. So David HaMelech was, oh, that guy doesn't understand it. Yeah, he's a fool, he's a ba'ar, he's a ksil. And the explanation is like this. If you come along and say that you don't understand anything in this world, then already you can add that to the list of things that you don't understand. Because actually the whole world is a complex place. We don't understand anything. Do we understand how a tree grows? Do we understand how our digestive system works? Do we understand the galaxies and the moon and the planets and blood cells? There's so many things in this world that are beyond our comprehension. But you know why that guy's a fool? Because the Pasuk writes, Ishbar lo yeda uksil lo yavin etzot. He comes to a whole complex world that doesn't understand anything, and he points to one item and says, yeah, why do wicked people prosper? But that's the only question you have. You figured out every other dilemma that's been plaguing scientists and people forever. You figured out exactly how your teeth grow. You figured out how the body knows exactly how to send the right vitamins to the right parts of the body without a manager inside your system. How your body's able to maintain 98.6 perfect temperature at all times without a thermostat. The Eskimo in the North Pole, 98.6. The guy on the beach in Honolulu, 98.6. Oh, there's no air conditioning, there's no heating system, there's no bill at the end of the month. Who's controlling the system? That you figured out? No, I don't have that question. Just explain me this one item over here. Why do the wicked people prosper? So David HaMelech says, you're a ba'ar, you're a ksil. Moshe Rabbeinu came along and said, I don't understand anything. Oh, you understand anything? You're normal. You're hakam, by the way. Now we'll deal. What's your question? But to come along in the cockpit and point to only one small little thing that you don't understand, even if it's a good question, but the way you ask it, as if just give me this answer, then I'm good. You're a tepesh, you're a fool. And that's why from the word mazot, from the word zot, which implies you're pointing out a single item, that's a question of a fool. A hacham concedes that he doesn't understand anything. One last point, a social commentary, which we usually give in this class, not always the most popular social commentaries, I might add, but it gives some people something to talk about what the rabbi said, what was his opinions. So we'll give you something to talk about for the next week on the rabbi's social commentary. Became a highlight of this class. What did the rabbi say? Actually, it's a positive comment, which is a rarity in this venue. Baruch Hashem, and maybe it's because I'm naive and I'm being set up, but I'd rather stay naive and get set up. Some of the organizers and the people that attended some of the trips that our community recently went on, wherever it might be, saw it their business to call me. Maybe in order to give me a proper perception, and all of the people that called me from the different places where they found themselves all relayed to me some of the most beautiful stories of how our community behaved and how they acted, and the camaraderie between the people and the unity between our people wherever they were, and the loyalty, and the minyanim, and the charity that was collected, but the behavior. I was in Florida the past few days, and the rabbi there got up and read a letter from the presidents of the buildings at Turnberry. that he sent the letter to the rabbi, and he says, "Rabbi, I want to let you know that all your constituents that came down from Brooklyn this year, they were well behaved, they were quiet, miracle of miracles, there was no incidents of mentioning, things were relatively calm, the hallways were calm, the pool was calm, everything was acceptable, and I want to commend you for a good work." And the same feelings of positive elements of the community was found wherever the people were. And that tells me that maybe we've reached rock bottom when it comes to our behavior on these trips. That's not us, of course, but the elements, kids, people that don't know better, and they give us a bad reputation. But Baruch Hashem, well, it wasn't perfect. Nothing has ever goes perfect. But scandals and events of worthy of note that haven't hit yet the front pages of our community, that's an accomplishment, where thousands of people have gone away and we've heard that everybody went safely and they came back safely and there was peace and people enjoyed themselves. That already shows you that our community has matured to a different level, that even our vacations now are taking on a more positive light, and we're more cognizant of that people are watching us and that people are talking, and that these people, which was five or six people, felt it important to call a rabbi and say, "Rabbi, you'd be proud." I'm sure they're exaggerating. They made it as if they went to a Beit Midrash and learned all day long. Don't fool me. I'm not a fool. I know you weren't sitting and learning all day long. You know, but still, if they're ready to have a conscience that they have to report to a rabbi, to at least let the rabbi think that everything's good, the people are good, everything, that's already a level that they have to check in, because they know that there's people are watching, people are concerned. And therefore, God bless you all. It's good to see you back. And you continue your good ambassadorship for our religion, both away and both here. Baruch Adonai Le'olam. Amen. Okay.